Recently, I had the chance to talk with Ron Paul and Dan McAdams on the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and I thought you might like to hear what we discussed.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
Daniel, we have a very special guest today. Both of us have worked with him for a long time, me longer than you. But today I want to welcome Lou Rockwell from the Institute, from the Mises Institute. Lou, welcome to our program.
Ron, it's great to be with you. I'm an admirer of this show. So Ron and Daniel, it's wonderful to be on the show.
Oh, wonderful. We're delighted you're here with us today. I want to go over a few things because a lot of people don't know you as well as I do. I was looking back trying to figure out how long I actually have known you, and I think I probably met you in the mid-70s. You were working for a magazine called Private Practice, and and you had you worked with Francis Davis, and he was a very good libertarian supporter. Unfortunately, with all his efforts, he didn't prevent so much damage that he foresaw in medicine. But that's been a good while ago. Now, Daniel has known you for a bit, for a shorter period of time. But my understanding is that after you left college, you started off into a lot of in publications where you were the where you were editor of several magazines. Is that correct?
Well, I was editor of the Private Practice magazine, but actually, first, I was a book editor, and I worked for a company called Arlington House, where I had an amazing thing happen to me. My boss, Neil McCaffrey, called me into his office, and he said, "How do you like to be Ludwig von Mises' editor?" So, of course, I was just very young. And so that was, of course, a tremendous experience.
Well, of course, at that particular time, you probably didn't know that you would have a Mises Institute.
No, that's right.
When did those ideas come together? I know we knew about it when you worked for me in the office, in the congressional office. But what really prompted you to make a precise decision to do what you did? And I know you made a commitment to Mrs. von Mises, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was concerned. I would say starting in the late 1970s when I was working for you, and of course you were the great expositor of Austrian economics and public life, as you have always been. But I was concerned that outside of you, really, the Austrian School of Economics was diminishing in importance. It was diminishing in its number of adherents, and that Mises' own reputation. And he was such, in addition to being a genius in economics and history and philosophy and so much else, he was just a hero. He was a great man, and I thought that it was a very sad thing and a bad thing that his reputation was diminishing just because people weren't learning about him. So I thought that. And you were wonderful to help right from the very beginning. You certainly agreed with me that it was important to increase knowledge of Austrian economics and to increase the knowledge of Mises. And so that's really what led me to do with it. I saw a need that had been a significant decline in the interest in Austrian economics in the academic world and just among the general public, too, after Mises' death. So I think thanks to you, thanks to Murray Rothbard, thanks to Margaret von Mises, thanks to so many great people, I think we reversed that. I think today Austrian economics is far better known than it was. Mises himself far better known. Rothbard, his great disciple, far better known. And so I think it's all over the world, as you know, when you go to speak in other countries, as well as when you speak here, whether it was during your campaigns or otherwise, you found tremendous interest, which, of course, you helped stoke in the Austrian school. And I think we're doing very, very well as the Keynesians, of course, are running everything in Washington. But outside of Washington, more and more interest in real economics and the free market and sound money, kinds of ideals that you've always stood for. We're continuing to make advances. So thank you, Ron, for all you've done in that cause.
Well, tell me what you think about the experience that you had in the early 80s when you worked in the congressional office. Was there anything that was, even with your preparation, that totally surprised you or anything that you have carried away that has been beneficial in promoting the cause of liberty since that time?
Well, I would say your steadfastness. The thing I remember most, and I remember many great things about the honor of working for you, but I can remember didn't matter who was putting the pressure on you. Ronald Reagan once called you to try to get you to vote for a military spending. Despite Reagan's reputation, he wasn't, of course, lobbying you for less spending. He was lobbying you for more spending, especially military spending to kill people. You didn't budge. He couldn't do it. He couldn't twist your arm. Your arm was untwistable. This was true of Newt Gingrich. It was true of all the Republican leaders, the big guys in the Republican Party, in the House, in the Senate, otherwise in the country. They couldn't make you do the wrong thing. So I've always thought, you know, that's the way a man should be. We should all strive to try to be a Ron Paul. Obviously, you know, there's only one Ron Paul. But the example that you set has inspired me ever since then, and I think inspired everybody who ever worked for you, everybody who ever had any dealings with you.
Now, Lou, one institute that I talk about a lot and you're familiar with, and that is the Fee Foundation, Leonard Reed's. And
yes.
Matter of fact, it was Leonard Reed that called me when you were thinking about coming to work for me, and I was very impressed with him. I had met you and known you. But Leonard Reed actually made a phone call to me, and I thought that was rather interesting because he wasn't exactly a political guy. So that sort of opened the door for us to have a conversation. But even later on, both you and I were on the board together at Fee when Senholz was the chairman of the board. So that's a group that had been helpful in the earlier years and is still around. So, but Daniel has had more recent experience getting to know you. He hasn't known you for 40 years. So, Daniel, do you have any questions for Lou?
I do. You know, it was... It was really thanks to you, Lou, who started publishing some of my works in the 90s where I was having a hard time getting anyone to publish. I didn't really know what I was. I just knew that the war in the Balkans was stupid and crazy. And that's where I discovered Ron Paul and discovered you. And you were able to connect a philosophy with what I had been feeling instinctively. But the thing is, I've known you and admired you so much over these few years that we've known each other. And you know, we both worked for Dr. Paul on the Hill. And I just can't help but asking, knowing you like I do now, what was it like when someone called and said, do you want to come work in Washington on Capitol Hill? What went through your mind?
Well, of course, Ron Paul's the only person I would have done that for. And for those who are big promoters of politics as a way to achieve things, I always think it's significant in the entire history of the American Republic, there's only been one Ron Paul. Doesn't mean there can't be others, but... pretty unusual man, and it was, of course, a great honor to work for him. And Daniel, I've always been impressed by you because you're a foreign policy expert who actually is a foreign policy expert. I mean, virtually everybody who comments on foreign policy is just a liar and a propagandist. You actually know what you're doing. You know the issues, you know the people, you know the history, you know all the interest groups and so forth. So I think this is why the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity has been so successful in such a short time, because to have somebody who actually knows all this stuff helping Dr. Paul and running it, it's great. It's a great thing. And again, shouldn't be so unusual, but it's very unusual.
Lou, you've been working in the trenches to try to promote the cause of liberty all these years, and it's essentially 40 years since the mid-70s that we met each other. But compare where the freedom movement was in the 70s compared to today. Because if you look at the evening news and you look at the disaster of monetary policy, economic policy, foreign policy in Washington, D.C., you know, you get one impression. But what is your impression about the progress, if we are making any progress compared to 40 years ago, on what's going on today?
Oh, I think there's been huge progress. Now, you're absolutely right. The commanding heights of the media and the government and so forth are all bad guys, all liars, all cheats, all people who, I mean, I always think it's a good idea. Don't even watch them. Don't turn on Fox. Don't turn on any of these networks. Get your news from the internet, from Daniel and at the Ron Paul Institute and other places like that. So you would absolutely get the impression that we're sunk, that the bad guys have won everything, they control everything. But actually, underneath that, especially among young people, and Ron, you have been the most powerful reason for this, there's been a huge difference, huge progress. I remember so strongly back in the last time you ran for president, the Pew Research people did a poll of young people who supported you, and they wanted to know what was the key issue. And of course, in those days, you were being demeaned as, oh, it's just because they want to smoke pot. And so it turned out that the key issue for young people was war and peace. They were against the wars. They wanted peace, and that's why they loved you. So I think that's just typical. And also the spread of interest in Austrian economics all around the world. This is a worldwide movement, not just in the United States. It's been so encouraging, so thrilling. So many smart, great young kids who are grown up to be professors themselves, for example, who are interested in real economics, understanding what the government does to the economy, why it shouldn't be doing it, why we shouldn't have a central bank like the Federal Reserve. Your great book, of course, and the Fed having something to do with that, too. So I think there's every reason to be optimistic in the long term, even though from the standpoint of the economy and what they're doing to the economy, we probably have some rough times ahead. But the long term future, I think, is very, very bright. And for that, for after all, we have the truth on our side. I mean, we can never forget that. They have lies on their side. We have the truth on our side.
Well, you know, you give me credit, and I was there, and I was a participant. But actually, I look at the ideas and who spread the ideas, and you know, the noted economists and Mises and Hayek and Murray Rothbard and others. But why I knew that you were having an effect, and others like you who have been teaching these issues, when I went to the campus. Now, I didn't go to a campus and convert these individuals, but it seemed to come together, because spontaneously, often I heard, or if I would, you know, inadvertently, you know, throw out the word Austrian economics or Murray Rothbard or Mises, the crowd was, I thought, how did they even know? So I was so impressed. So it was sort of a symbiosis there of a discovery that a lot of hard work had been done. And of course, we hope to keep this momentum going.
I remember in 2008, when you went to the University of Michigan campus, and first of all, they were all shocked that 4,000 students turned out in the quadrangle to hear you. But even you were surprised when you started talking about monetary policy. These kids started chanting on their own, end the Fed, end the Fed. And that's, of course, where you got the title for your book. So I think it's true, you know, and you drew such huge crowds, such passionate kids. We hear now, of course, they're promoting Bernie Sanders, the socialist communist senator from Vermont, because he draws hundreds of kids. You drew thousands of kids. And of course, the difference, Sanders is, of course, promoting very bad ideas, very, very damaging, horrendous ideas. You were promoting the truth. And I think the kids responded. So I think all the work that you did, if you go to campus, you go to campuses today, you get the same tremendous response. There's something as magical has happened, something wonderful has happened. And it's why, again, I think we can't be discouraged by the Republican or the Democrats or the Congress or the presidency. They're all a problem. But underneath that, in the real America, great things are happening.
You know, one more item about the Michigan visit that I remember well. Not only did they shout out end the Fed, but they started burning Federal Reserve notes. I really got a charge out of that. Daniel, you have a question for Lou?
It was good. They were diminishing the money supply.
Yeah, there you go. That was doing a good job.
Well, Lou, we're going to touch on a couple of current affairs if you have a few minutes still with us.
Sure.
One of the things I love about LouRockwell.com, and I read it every day, as a matter of fact, I stay up till midnight to catch the new edition, but it's just absolutely fearless. And I often find myself thinking, I can't believe he put that up. You know, it's great. But so one of the things I was going to ask you with that in mind is, you know, the big deal this past week has been the Chinese have hacked all of our computers. You know, they have all this information. And I'm, you know, sort of putting my Lou Rockwell cap on, I'm thinking, isn't this kind of suspicious that this is just a couple of weeks after this big to-do about these islands in the South China Sea, right off of China's coast, that somehow the U.S. thinks it has the right to? You know, doesn't it seem to be there a relationship between these two events?
You know, I can remember a few years ago when Bill Kristol was writing in the Weekly Standard and denouncing the Chinese. And one of his charges against the Chinese was they want to be the dominant power in the South China Sea, when, of course, the U.S. should be the dominant power. I mean, it's a little bit like saying, you know, the U.S. wants to be the dominant power in the Gulf of Mexico. So the Chinese aren't building any islands there either. So this is very, very interesting. Of course, they're the two significant countries in the world from an economic standpoint and a military standpoint who are not under U.S. control are China and Russia. So, of course, we hear them being attacked all the time. Did the Chinese hack I mean, the U.S. hacks China and Russia, of course, every day, has been doing it for a very long time and planting deadly worms into other people's computer systems and so forth. The U.S. is the big cyber hacker and spy, cyber spy of the whole world. So if the Chinese respond, I don't know. We're told that they or the Russians are, you know about American spies. Well, is spying such a great thing? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it'd be a good thing if there's less spying in the world. But I think you're right. It's not at all a coincidence that, again, it's the hate war against China and Russia because they're independent of the U.S. That's the only reason. Are there something wrong with these countries? No. Of course, just like the U.S., they've got things wrong with them. On the other hand, I was thrilled to see Donald Trump, who I must say I find very interesting, but he had a typically stupid comment about China's stealing American jobs and it's manipulating its currency and so forth. And there was a spokesman from the Chinese foreign ministry who gave a great pro-capitalist explanation of why trade between China, among China and the U.S. is a great thing for both countries and for businessmen in both countries or consumers in both countries. And I thought, you know, the so-called communist Chinese know more, far more economics than Donald Trump does. So it's very interesting.
There's a hearing going on in Congress today. And, you know, we're pretty negative on what's going on in Washington. And I'm just wondering whether you can find a bit of optimism with this hearing, very important hearing being held by the Budget Committee. And their hearing is to talk about how the Republicans are going to support and bring about a balanced budget.
Well, you know, as you've always pointed out, there's off-budgets. First of all, we should mention there's off-budget spending. There's the official budget, but there's all kinds of spending that goes on off-budget. We wish we could do that in our own lives, right? If the family budget is under strain, you just do the spending off-budget. So that's the government. And the Republicans, of course, have never been for balanced budgets. This is just a propaganda trick. Democrats, of course, have their propaganda tricks, too. But anytime the Republicans have had control of the government, under Reagan and under Bush and so forth, of course they don't balance the budget. They believe in deficits. And I remember a high official of the Reagan Treasury telling in a small meeting that I was honored to be in with you that they had sent a balanced budget up to Reagan for his first budget, and the White House sent it back and said, "No, we want a big deficit," because they believe in deficits. They want deficits. The Republicans do not believe in balanced budgets.
But, you know, talking about the off-budget stuff, what about the trillions and trillions of dollars that they manufactured by the Fed? It used to be the Congress would spend the money, sell the treasury bills, and the Fed would monetize them. Now they just go and they buy bad mortgage debt, and they skip Congress altogether. And, oh, yeah, we're going to work on a balanced budget.
You know, it's one of the terrible things about having a Federal Reserve, having a central bank, that today, when the Congress is trying to decide whether who should they kill next, who they're going to bomb next, what war should they start next, there's never a consideration about how we're going to pay for it. That's not even an issue because, of course, the Fed will print up the money.
And Lou, we're going to have to finish up here. This has been a great conversation, but I wanted to ask you about a Texas issue, and it's made national news. Texas governor just recently signed a law that establishes the Texas Gold Bullion Repository, and they're talking about assuming that the states are allowed to use gold and silver as money. Is this extremism? Or are they usurping powers from the federal government, or do you find this of some interest?
Well, let's hope. I mean, I hope they're usurping power. They're actually, the federal government, of course, has usurped powers from the states and localities. And so this is a wonderful development. They're also wanting to take back $1 billion in Texas gold being held by the New York Fed. And of course, everybody should take their gold back, whether it's other countries or the state of Texas, take it back from the Fed. And there's international interest in this. Apparently, there's been an outpouring of people who want to store their gold from internationally and domestically in the Texas Gold Bullion Depository rather than with the banks. You can't trust the banks, obviously. People feel you can trust the state of Texas more than the banks. Probably is true. Nothing's more untrustworthy than a bank. So I think this is a thrilling thing. It's I think, increasing, despite, of course, you would never know this from the media, but there's, of course, I think, increasing interest in gold as money, as well as and when the banks are saying you can't keep it in the safe deposit box. Government doesn't like gold. Banks don't like gold. But the people do like gold. And you've been a long-term advocate of a gold standard, the kind of money that people would choose in the market, which is, I think, would be a gold standard. And we're just sick and tired of the evil of the Federal Reserve, the redistributionary effects, the business cycle effects, all the terrible things that the Federal Reserve does, and of course, pretending to be smarter than the rest of us. They're just more criminal.
I think it's an example also of nullification, setting the stage that a state and individuals can go about their business. I believe that nullification will come not because Congress is going to pass a law or recognize it as a principle, but the federal government is going to become so inept in financial affairs that people are just going to march on their own way and they're going to have to take care of themselves. Anyway, Lou, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Very interesting conversation. And congratulations on the wonderful job you've done with the Institute, the Mises Institute, over the many years.
Ron, thanks so much. Daniel, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you.